Hey team, today I am super excited to talk to someone I've gotten to know recently. His name is Joe Musselman. Joe is a venture capitalist, extremely thoughtful businessman, someone involved in helping the United States and its allies in national security through technology and other venture investments. Especially recently, Joe announces here on the podcast a new initiative that his firm, Broom Ventures, is undergoing in that vein. He also explains for the first time, or at least one of the rare times, explains the background behind the name Broom Ventures, which definitely resonates with me. Joe is also someone who's been highly influential in helping fellow SEALs like myself and their families through the Honor Foundation. And Joe speaks at length about his journey with the Naval Special Warfare community, that is the SEAL teams. And Joe became, unfortunately, due to no fault of his own, kind of an outsider from the teams. He went to BUDS, like yours truly, and suffered some ill-fated consequences that ended his SEAL dream early. And Joe talks about how that shaped him and how he bounced back from what could have been considered a failure. And I think that that applies to all walks of life, whether that be business, family, or a startup. And I think we can learn a lot from that. Joe is extremely thoughtful, and I am very privileged to know him. I say this pretty much every time for all the great guests I have, but I just thoroughly enjoyed this wide-ranging conversation where Joe goes deep on how he thinks about the human operating system, how he structures his life for success, and what it's like to lead as an investor and with very competent CEOs in startups, where Joe and his team's mantra of team's leadership culture can improve all of these other mini cultures within the Broom portfolio. So really hope you enjoy this as much as I did. I have no doubt you will take at least a few kernels of wisdom away from my guest, Joe Musselman. Joe, can you tell us what I think, at least from the outside in, is your origin story, or at least something that's been super foundational to who you are? Again, from the outside and only knowing you a little bit here over the last year or two, which is, I think, your entry into BUDS and what happened after that.
I guess starting with the Honor Foundation is a good place, obviously, to begin. But one thing I think is important to mention too is coming into the Navy, I was also coming off of a long standing tradition of service in my family. I was there's been 20, but at the time I was about the 16th man in my family to serve in the United States military, going all the way back to the Revolutionary War. My great, 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 great grandfather wintered at Valley Forge. He was of the Pennsylvania Musselmans, and he served beside Alexander Hamilton and George Washington. I have their regimental flag right to my left that I found online. And so, you know, I grew up seeing all types of uniforms in every closet of every home, and hearing stories of, you know, different boot camp experiences to deployment experiences, you know, from World War I to World War II to Korea to Iraq 1 and 2. I've seen and heard all types of stories from there. So coming into the Navy was never really a matter of if I were to join. It was more a matter of when I would join. And so I took a year post-college, year and a half, to get ready to go into the Navy with every intention to become a SEAL. About 2.5 years into my training pipeline, I suffered a wicked injury, and unfortunately, I had to transition out. It was, you know, the old saying, you want to make God laugh, tell him about your plans. So that's exactly what happened there, as I'm looking up to the sky, kind of cursing, you know, God, ironically saying, you better have a plan for this. Well, it turns out it certainly was a plan, because as I transitioned over 10 months of rehabilitation at Naval Special Warfare Command on Coronado, I transitioned into recognizing that there was a significant need for transition support for members of the special operations community. And it was going through that transition myself, and then also with the perfect chip on my shoulder, a very productive chip, to want to continue to provide value to a community that I deeply admired, that led me to find something called the Honor Foundation. And now you flash forward, my gosh, almost a decade now from when we initially founded in 2013, 2014 is when we launched. We've put nearly 70 plus groups or 2,000 families through a 12 to 15 week program. Think of it as an executive MBA program in transition, in military transition. And now we've put over 2,000 families in jobs. So it's quite a remarkable story. It was what I was always meant to do. I was never meant to be a SEAL. I was meant to serve the SEAL and special operations community, which then translated into venture very well. And then I'll also transition into what I'm doing now with Bravo Victor, which is more of a defense-focused fund. So going back to the root of the story, the founding story was really the community telling me what they wish they would have had, more so than me figuring out something unique. So I interviewed over 216 of your teammates across the country over 7 states, over 6 months, and asked them all a set of 33 questions. It's the first rule of design thinking, right, is to empathize with the community you mean to serve. And that's exactly what I did. So with that being said, that's the kind of the launch story into how I formed the Honor Foundation. And of course, leaving out all of the specific startup woes and stories and trenches and failures for us to talk about as we go through this and navigate this conversation. But that was the launch of my professional career post the United States Navy.
That sounds great. It's an epic story full of wise tidbits there. I'm curious what that was like right after you were injured, sorting through all of that, because I think that that's a place where a lot of people can get stuck, right? Whether it's family issues, whether it's they get laid off from a job, which a lot of people unfortunately can relate to right now in the economy, or they start their startup, doesn't pan out, all sorts of stuff, right? And I think that a lot of us get stuck there and have a really tough time getting out of that. So, without either of us trying to play mental health professional necessarily, which would be dubious, just tell us about how did you sort through that? What were those struggles like? What were you telling yourself positively or negatively?
Yes. Great question. So the mental fitness of Joe Musselman in that moment was poor. So I could tell you that my self-talk was very negative. And I remember the exact turning point of what I was reminded of that helped me. And this might be useful for folks that are also struggling at the moment with their own self-talk or just with their own mental fitness. I had someone walk up to me who's now become this kind of archetype to reflect on in moments like this, where he walked up to me without knowing me. He saw me mustering with all the folks that were, for the folks that are listening, mustering is a military word for, meeting as a group. All right. So we were mustering in the morning at about 0700. And someone came literally out of the ocean. It was soaking wet and he just got done with some PT and some other things. And he walked up to me and without knowing, mind you, this was a complete stranger at the time. Now he's become a friend. And, I always tell this story with incredible humility and gratitude for him, for having the kind of the, I don't even know what you would call it, for coming up to me, a stranger, looking at me in my eyes and saying, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. And just walked away like some sort of nudge from God, like just walked up to me. I'm on crutches. I got a brace on. I had all this stuff wrong with me. And as most high kind of performing athletes know that when you ramp up training for such a long time, years, and then you come to a screeching halt, your whole body just stops and is trying to catch up with all of the injury that you ignored. And everything came kind of crumbling down the minute that I left. But your mind, it's also fun, interesting to note that as soon as your mind stops moving forward and stops, the body believes it. And so the body stops and the body starts to pay attention to things it wasn't paying attention to before because the mind was so preoccupied with moving forward. But regardless, I can tell you that, you know, the experience of having him walk up to me and say, this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. It set me down a journey that very night to look up in my, you know, laptop, and I started poking around and prodding around. I found an old letter of recommendation that the chair of the political science department at DePaul University wrote on my behalf to get into the Navy. He was one of my letters of recommendation. And I remember reading that letter and those words and thinking to myself, who is he talking about? Like, honestly asking myself, like, who is he describing? I don't feel like this person at all. What it did do, I get goosebumps like telling that story because, you know, what it did do is it set me on a path of muscle memory. And I read that letter of recommendation every day until I started to feel more like that old self. And in the moment, it was really hard. And as soon as I started to feel this transition happen from the mentality that the mental state that I was currently in to more of the mental state of this person that he was describing in this letter, I noticed I started to see the world a little differently. And do not get me wrong, I was most certainly suffering some form of depression. I was never diagnosed. I was never, you know, I never would, at that point in time, I would never actually go and seek out that type of support. But I can tell you that it was intense. I felt this like malaise, this layer of everything in the world seemed like a little yellow, a hint of yellow. I can remember it like it was yesterday. And then all of a sudden, the technicolor started to come back into my vision when I started to pretend to be like the person that was described in that letter of recommendation. So you asked what was going through my mind. Well, a lot. And of course, I felt like I let down my family, my posterity. You know, folks like us, we tend to put a lot more responsibility and weightiness on our shoulders of certain things. Maybe so than others, or just differently. We carry the load a little differently. But that's how I got out of that funk.
That's incredible. So it sounds like you didn't know you were in the midst of some depression at that time. And I've heard other people say this, notably Tim Ferriss, and I've experienced it myself, where I think the phrase is something like, you know, I just didn't know how bad I was at the time, right? So again, you know, we might be getting out a little over our skis here if we go too far here, but I think these anecdotes from, you know, really successful people like yourself who have battled through this, right? And again, sample size of one, but you know, like what would you look for in the future, right? We're all going to go through tough times throughout our lives. You know, now that you're aware a little more of yourself, probably. You know, what would you look out for, and maybe like sanity check of like, oh wow, I'm going to a bad place. Maybe I need some help. Maybe I need to talk to somebody. Maybe I need to remember these kind of techniques that I use.
Yeah, before. Sure. I mean, those, we all have our demons. We're all walking around a bundle of stories, that we tend to go to one way or the other, but I can certainly tell you that, you know, when you are at your best and you know, when you are not, or let me put it this way. We know when we're at our best. We also know when we are partaking in things that make us weaker, not stronger. So I think that's a good way to think about it, is it's very clear. Everyone who's listening to this right now, you all could take a piece of paper and write down exactly behaviors that you are doing right now that are making you weaker, not stronger. I do it. I do it all the time. I do it on a weekly basis, right? There are things that you do that made you weaker and not stronger. And so I think paying close attention to yourself and watching yourself as a stranger very objectively in regards to your behavior, to your words you're using, to the people that are around you, to the ideas that you're pursuing, whether those ideas are a worthy and just cause versus in your pursuit, or are they taking away from are they taking away from what you could be doing productively as someone who's trying to give something special to the world? That's a constant audit that has to take place. And it's certainly something that I talk with my founders about all the time. Are the things that they're doing that give them strength as a leader of a team, or that are making the team weaker by perhaps not discussing something at length?
Yeah, I love that framing, Joe. The looking at your activities, what's weaker, what's making you stronger, because I feel like it synthesizes all the types of behaviors that could be negative,
yes,
or positive, very nice, yes, right? Like, you know, if you're drinking too much, right? If you're, you know, whatever, complaining too much, resenting people,
that's right,
barking back, right, at people, you know, whatever, addicted to porn, like, that's all right, the things that you, that's could, right, do. And it's
all the things, right?
It's a very good litmus test. I can
tell you this.
It's a very smart
litmus. My wife, for those of you listening, if your significant other, your spouse, your partner, whomever you call the closest person to you, I can tell you right now, if you allow them the ability to provide critiques to you in a very personal way, when they recognize a change in the way you are thinking, acting, feeling, and communicating with them, they're going to be the first ones to notice it. They'll notice it before you notice it. And allowing them the peace of mind to critique in the moment, or like, for instance, my wife, I told her the best way to make critiques to me when I seem very head down and focused is just to gently touch me in some way. And I think this is important because something happens when someone you love places their hand on you. And so she'll put her hand on my arm and she'll say, "Hey, I want to talk to you about something important." And now you have my attention undividedly. Like, you have my attention undividedly. Because I know that's like our trigger phrase, right? Like, I have something I've talked to you about that's important. Now I know she's being very serious, right? So and then she will critique in some way. I've noticed that this is happening or that's happening, or you're shorter fuse, or what's going on. She doesn't ever judge and doesn't default to me being rude, or she knows that something is going on, right? And it extends well beyond the relationship. It extends into partnerships that I have. It extends into, like, the more comfortable you are within yourself, the broader of a circle you will allow those critiques to go, right? And that's important. And you have to be careful. I had who's now become a friend and obviously a mentor, but there's a 4-star admiral that gave me a wonderful critique back in the day, back in 2014 when I was building the Honor Foundation. He said, "Joe, you are caring too much about people that don't matter." And so so it's one thing to care too much about people, right, and what they say, but it's another thing to care too much about people that just don't matter. And so I said, "Sir, you know, can you tell me about the people that do matter and give me those profiles of the folks that do matter and I should be paying attention to?" And he did, and he introduced me to all of them. Right. So therefore, he right there in a single day's introductions, he upped my inner circle, right, which allowed me to be more focused, and I always say this about the Honor Foundation, I have hundreds of co-founders, hundreds. Like, this was not a sole effort. This was, it took someone not from the community, but someone who aspired to be in the community and then taken out of the community to go build this for the community.
Hey gang, quick note here. I've moved a ton of my efforts in terms of content creation to LinkedIn. So if you don't follow me on LinkedIn, please do. I've been posting a lot there. I've gotten a lot of great feedback. Feel free to stalk my profile and check out a lot of the old posts. Most of them should be evergreen. I very rarely comment on today's news. I post on the same sorts of topics I post on here. Leadership topics, as well as things about business, things about really just getting out of your own head, right? And trying to achieve the goals that you want to achieve in your life, but can't seem to sometimes, or maybe aren't doing so fast enough, or maybe just aren't finding fulfilling. There's a lot of things that we can do, practical tools that we can apply in our own life. I try and share them here, but for the stuff that doesn't go into this, because a podcast is a lot of work. Not sure if the word's gotten out. I love it. That's why I do it. I do it because it's hopefully providing value to you, but I can't put everything into a podcast. So I do that generally on LinkedIn now. I'm also on Medium. I'm also on Instagram, those sorts of things, but LinkedIn is where I'm at right now. So please follow me. My full name is Andrew Sridhar. That is S as in Sam, R-I, D as in David, H-A-R. That's how my dad used to spell it all the time on the landline phone growing up. And even though I go by Sri, you will find me under both those monikers on LinkedIn. So hope to see you there. Enjoy the rest of the program.
I will just say, I have always noticed you were mentioning how you had hundreds of co-founders with the Honor Foundation. And honestly, man, in all the your profile on LinkedIn, everywhere else, you've been remarkably humble about your contributions there, which I think is an amazing credit to you. But a big, giant, thank you to you for doing that, because I know, personally, so many guys who have benefited from that. So, okay, so we kind of had you on the psychologist couch there. I've got one more question before we let you off. Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. So the last question of this vein is, there's something to leading oneself. And, I kind of cringe at that phrase, but we talk about it a lot in the culture. And it is, if you can't drive yourself, if you can't exercise agency, and be thoughtful about what you're doing, right? How are you ever going to lead other people? So there's this notion, right, of an operating system for the self, right? So I'm curious if that resonates for you. I mean, you're in the venture capital community, and people who are in the entrepreneurial world tend to talk about that kind of stuff a lot. So I'm guessing, you're at least familiar with the term. But more than that, right? I'm curious. Do you, as a very thoughtful guy, as you've already exhibited here in our little time together on the podcast, do you have certain, things that you knit together in terms of your personal routine, whether that be on a minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly basis, how you incorporate your network into that, how you incorporate, your plans and vision and goals, and then act on them, right? Because it's easier said than done, and no one teaches you this stuff in school, even though they probably should.
So the HOS, right? The human operating system. I can say that I have a very unique and probably too strict of a standard, truly, of self-organization. Because whether you folks who are really head down and trying to build things will understand, you included, will understand what I mean by you can forget to self-audit. All right, that sounds maybe silly at the surface, but you can forget to be mindful and protective of yourself and what's coming into the input side, and then recognizing what happens in the output side. So I've logged thousands of hours on two apps. So the one app obviously is Calm. And the second app is maybe not so obvious, but should be, is called Waking Up. And it's a phenomenal app of conversations. And I use Sam's conversations for self-guided meditation. But more importantly are the conversations that take place between the guests. They're much deeper. And I would imagine that if people around the world would spend a couple of hours listening to experts in the field of mental fitness and mindfulness, just have conversations about that topic, your life would drastically improve, wildly improve. And so those are two apps that I spend a lot of time in. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, the your surroundings, whether it be your physical surroundings, and you know, people are also part of your physical surroundings. So I think taking some time to self-audit who you are surrounding yourself with and their, how they are auditing their behaviors, their thoughts, their actions, their feelings, plays a big part in that. I tend to gravitate towards people that can openly and freely exchange ideas, away from personal opinions, but have very rigorous conversations around the idea, without laying opinions on the table is right or is wrong. So I do think that folks should spend more time, you know, perhaps thinking about who is, you hear it all the time. You're the average of the five people you surround yourself with. There's universal truths that exist in our lives for a reason, for a purpose, by design. People should pay more attention to those types of things when they can very easily go by the wayside. You know, this also goes into another good point, Andrew, that comes to mind. I was having a conversation with someone about a comment or a quote or that we had heard where if you cannot fire your employees, you work for them. If you can fire employees, they clearly work for you. And it wasn't a conversation about the harsh language of to use fire or not fire, but it was for the idea that I was focused on military leadership. So in the military, leaders can't fire their employees. So I don't know if the private sector or the commercial sector understands this, but you are given a set of individuals, and then you are given those individuals to work with, right? You can't fire people in the military. You can get people reassigned and like things of that nature, but overall, it's even very hard and not worth the paperwork to reassign someone once they've been kind of billeted toward to you. In the private sector, if someone's not working out, the lingering possibility of being fired or getting fired or being let go is always kind of there. So that has molded a certain type of leader, knowing that they have this authority and this command of authority, where in the military, you don't have that authority. So it's forged a certain type of leader to learn how to be more inclusive, how to lead by example, than the private sector necessarily understands. So again, there's something about the culture that is that attracted me, that has attracted millions of people before you, before myself, to go and serve inside of this community or a community in the military because of the leadership aspect of that. And I do feel that the private sector has wonderful leaders. And it's funny how the ones who act and behave more like an inclusive leader, as if these people are the people that I have to work with, and they don't just refer back to kind of the Welchian tactic of the, if you are in the bottom, you are fired. And if you are not in the bottom, we will continue to improve you. But there's that fear of psychological unsafety inside most teams. So that has forged a different leader, which is why I think standouts in the private sector and standouts, especially in the entrepreneurship community that I work with day in and day out, it's so obvious to see the ones that are going to be great 21st century leaders. So anyways, that's just a big part of my daily routine is understanding who's coming in and out of my days.
Yeah, that's such an awesome framing. And I you know, for folks who will see me on video, they will have seen me nodding vigorously with the you can't fire people in the military point, because I bring this up all the time, you know, whether it's in my work or in the podcast or elsewhere, in my attempts to contribute out there in the ecosystem of leadership, because it really is such a stark difference. And when you can't fire people, your mental calculus for what you do and how you move forward is just so fundamentally different. And you pointed out another great nuance there. I usually think about it in the, hey, what are we doing to mentor and train and integrate people and make them successful? But you brought up something that is equally, if not more insightful, which is the way those leaders will carry themselves is also fundamentally different. And I think if one looks, at least those of us who have had the privilege of being both on the military and the private sector side, right? If you look at the individuals, usually in the private sector, who are, you know, for lack of a better phrase, kind of terrible leaders. It often probably can be attributed to that, right? Is that they have that ultimate recourse and are emboldened to accentuate the worst sides of themselves, probably.
Yeah, and you know, you said something so quickly that I don't want it to be lost on the listeners or you. It certainly wasn't lost on me. You said my attempts to contribute something in the leadership kind of realm, right? And I that's a challenge, in my opinion, to people that are listening to this. You humbly stated, like, my attempts at contributing to a broader leadership discussion. How are you contributing to a broader leadership conversation? And this is to the audience. Like, if you were to sit back at the end of the day and say, how did I contribute or hope to contribute to a leadership conversation today amongst my colleagues, my peers, even those that work that are in my charge versus those that are in charge of me? How have you forced a greater conversation onto the table to learn from other people around you or to provide other people around you with mentorship around leadership? It's one of those things that you don't have to, everyone is a leader and you can be a leader where you are right now in this moment in time, but it'll only actually, you will really begin to contribute to a leadership conversation when you believe yourself to be a leader. But before that, it's not going to have a significant effect on your life, not believing yourself to actually be one. And that goes for single moms working three jobs to, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, this is the whole point of being a leader, is you can lead where you are with what you have. The question is whether or not you believe it to be so.
Totally. So I'm tempted to skip over the obvious question that anyone should ask you, at least someone from the military formerly like myself, which is advice for vets, right? Like, if you could distill it down, I think, you know, we could point them to the Honor Foundation. There's going to be an enormous amount of resources there. But I would be remiss if I didn't ask you that. But I think there's a flip side to that question too, that I probably don't ask military guests enough, which is, so yeah, first off, you know, what are like the, you know, one, two, three things that every vet getting out should have on their mind, right? And then secondly, though, for those people who, you know, because we're not perfect, veterans are not perfect, right? There are some good lessons that I think you and I learned in the military that can apply and we're trying to help people with in the private sector. But, you know, for those folks who did not have the privilege to serve in the military, like, what are just some of the non-obvious takeaways for them, right? Because there's a lot more of them than there are of us veterans. Yeah.
So the first question is, you know, what would I tell a veteran who perhaps is in transition or even has transitioned and is now working in the private sector? And then also, what you know, what opinions can I share with folks not from the military, from the military? Right, yep. Lessons I can share with folks not from the military. So here's the first thing that I would say to any veteran who is approaching a state of transition, right? Because there's one thing that is certain in regards to your service. It will come to an end. So for anyone who's listening to this or watching this, just know that there's one certainty that you can guarantee will happen, which is your service will come to an end, right? So this is also very appropriate for those folks who are in an active state of transition, 12 to 18 months, if you're in your wheelhouse of transition. And I want you to pay attention to this. And it's so simple. And I've kind of boiled it down to, you know, a whole equation, but the equation ends with something called TLC. And I talk about this all the time. Teams, leadership, and culture. That's hopefully when I said TLC, you went to a warm, fuzzy place, right? Like, you know, tender loving care. Well, TLC, teams, leadership, and culture, I want you to go there anyways. But the point of teams, leadership, and culture for those veterans who are in active transition, how often have you thought about the teams that you have served within and broken down the ingredients of those teams, both good and bad? Because what you're really trying to do in a state of transition from military to the commercial sector is you're trying to replicate certain things that made you feel a certain way while you were inside of the teams, all right, while you were inside of your military community. So think of teams in your history having an ingredients panel, and you have to break those down. What was it about those teams? Did they have a clear vision? Were they mission-centric? Did they have a certain set of core values? Did they live by certain principles? What was the ethos of that team, right? The character, the integrity. So what I just listed out is vision, mission, values, principles, ethos, right? Those are the five driving forces that equal extraordinary teams, leaders, and cultures. So when you think about teams from your military service, I want you to be surgical about dissecting those teams and understanding what comprised the high-performing teams from an attribute perspective that you loved. The next thing is leadership. All right. Each one of those teams had a leader. Throughout your time inside the military, you had good leaders and you had bad leaders. How often have you gone back to analyze what those leaders, unbelievable, memorable, remarkable leaders? Okay. Was it their vision? Was it how they executed missions? Was it their values? Did they believe in certain principles? Was it their ethos, their character, or integrity? Again, go through that list for leaders. And then you have the last component, which is culture, right? Do an audit of the culture that you've been a part of. And what was it about that culture that was so extraordinary? Was it the vision of that culture? Was it how mission-centric the culture was? Was it the set of values that helped forge that particular culture in the military? What were the principles that your culture followed? And most importantly, if you could describe the integrity, the character, the ethos of that community and the SEAL community, they have something called the SEAL ethos, right? And the funny thing about the SEAL ethos, it was written in the perfect way where it only resulted in two answers, which are the only two answers you need to have when you're using something to, I define the ethos of an organization, like the About Us page, right? The ethos, I call it the unspoken spirit manifested, right? It's the way things are done around here. And if you read that SEAL ethos, I would challenge everyone on this call to go and look it up, type in Navy SEAL ethos and you'll read it. And it does one of two things. You either read that and say, hell yes, that's for me. Or you read that and say, hell no, that is not for me. That's when you know you have perfectly described the way things are done around here, right? It's the ultimate HR mechanism, that SEAL ethos. If it's done correctly, an individual ethos should describe you in an unspoken way, like not how you typically describe yourself, but when you describe yourself according to your ethos, your character, your integrity, you define it. People should understand and know who you are. That's hard to do, and not a lot of people take time to do that, right? So long longer, analyzing teams, leadership, and culture while you are in transition from your military service, what you're really doing is you're creating a sense, you're creating a language that defines all the things that gave you joy while you were in service. And now you become a hunter versus the hunted, okay? Like that is a big difference when you go out to the world with a clearly defined teams, leadership, and culture set of ingredients to go out and overlay that on different organizations, because then you'll say, this is for me, this is not for me. You'll say, this organization believes what I believe or they don't believe what I believe. But this creates a level of clarity, I think, for veterans to think of their transition of an audit of past teams, leaders, and cultures that brought them joy. All of those ingredients. And now I'm hunting organizations in the private sector that inspire me, right? That inspire me in the direction of these things. That's what I would say to the veteran. Now to the commercial side, to the folks who, you know, what am I going to gain by bringing someone from the veteran community on board? This, you know, my organization or my institution. They have to really think. There's one story in particular that really encompasses this, and it's a quick story. But there was an individual going through the Honor Foundation whose reputation preceded him. He was a very well-known operator. He had spent 20 years at Development Group. For the folks listening, Development Group is the SEAL Team 6 that we don't hear about, or that we hear about, or we don't know exists, or we know exists. And so he was very reputable, and he came from that kind of elite background. And someone made the mistake in the middle of a class to say something. One of our faculty members made the mistake of saying, you know, if I tell you to go break that clock, you know, in the private sector, and I'm, you know, your boss, you got to go break the clock. And that's something that, you know, military people are really good at doing, is just following orders. Like, okay, go break the clock. Got it. I'm gonna go break the clock. And all of a sudden you see this guy raise his hand, this gentleman that was in my class from this very kind of prestigious elite operating background. And he said, that's not at all how people in my community react to a command to go break the clock. And he's like, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, first off, sir, I'm going to ask you, why are we breaking that clock? And then I'm going to ask you, are there any components of that clock that we need to keep? And then I'm going to ask you, is there a particular time of day that we have to go get this clock? And most importantly, what intel led to that particular clock in this moment in time? And he went through this list of questions, off, like just like this, was rattling them off, this operating list that was ingrained in his soul of operating. And the faculty member kind of sat back and goes, you know, my God, all I wanted you to do was to go break the clock. I thought you guys were great at following orders. He said, no, we're great at critical thinking. We do follow orders, but not after we've critically thought about the order that we're following. And it completely, in one single moment, it transformed the way that the person then saw the classroom and the body of talent that was in front of him in one single exchange, right? So I do think that too many people, too often in the private sector, have a judgment call of military in their mind of what this person has done because they were in the military. And most of the time, like most judgments around a stereotype, are typically wrong, or they rhyme, but they're not right. They might rhyme, but they're not exactly right. So every single branch, every single service member, they're all very different from each other. They come from a different set of experiences. And this is another kind of poke at, you know, CHROs and CEOs. When I founded the Honor Foundation, I interviewed around 150 Fortune 500 CEOs. It took me a long time to do this, about 6 months. And one of my favorite questions to ask them was, do you recruit MBAs the same way that you recruit undergrads? And the answer is obviously no, right? They said, no, of course not. We have, you know, different teams that go out to recruit from different MBA programs, and we have different undergrads, you know, teams that go out to recruit from the undergraduate, you know, programs on the country. And I said, okay, well, do you recruit special operation veterans the same as you recruit all veterans? And the answer unanimously was no, we don't. Meaning we recruit everyone the same from a veteran community, right? So I said, look, the community would never say this, but there is that word special in front of special operations, right? They won't lead with it, but they are in fact special, and they should be recruited differently than a general force. And there's absolutely no one from the general force that would argue that point, that they should all be recruited the same. It comes from a different set of experiences. So overcoming the education gap, I think, is a big hurdle for the private sector and the commercial sector, which is why the Honor Foundation focused so specifically on educating two sides of a one bridge, where you have to educate the special operations community of the other side of the bridge. And most importantly, educate themselves on themselves as they go across that bridge. And then educating the private sector on who's on the other side as well. Because then when they meet in the middle of the bridge, now everyone knows about each other, right? They can shake hands, understanding where folks are coming from and their backgrounds. Those are probably two things I would mention.
Yeah. Yeah. Those stories are great. The one, I don't want audience members who aren't veterans to get the wrong takeaway from the critical thinking story that you related, in that there's the critical thinking component, but also military members, especially special operators, but I would generalize to the military as well, do exercise incredible degrees of ownership. And so there's the message to Garcia story that, you know, I think I've related here on the podcast before, right? But and I'll spare the audience, I'll spare you, Joe. But basically, it's a story about, you know, having a mission that is very uncertain and very ambiguous, and filling in the path without necessarily a lot of questions, but yet with a very high degree of critical thinking along the way. So I don't want people to take away from this, oh, okay, well, you're just going to ask a bunch of questions and ask permission and how to do everything. Cause that is certainly not the case. I think that individual is using that list as a tool to make a very specific point there. But an important one. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And that's also a great reminder. I mean, there's, when people talk about the military, especially the special operations community, there's either entrepreneurs or entrepreneurs in this community, right? That's it. And what I mean by those two categories is they're either going to go off and innovate in a direction on their own, or they're going to go into an organization and innovate inside another organization to drive innovation from within and out. The community, this is why a third of our community goes into technology startups, right? A third of our community at the Honor Foundation, 30% or so go into technology startups. Why? Because there's a certain level of uncertainty there. There's a certain level of, I will land and expand and be relevant instantly there, right? So that is what this community is great at doing, of landing somewhere, creating relevance instantly, no job too small or big, and working their way to figure things out. There's so many stories that I could tell you from listening to employers recite back to me the benefits of hiring someone from the special operations community. They're some of the most thoughtful. And I think one stereotype that is not cast enough over the community is their level of empathy for their teammates, their colleagues, and most importantly, the world. You know, you hear this community because it's a tough community, or it's a tough brand to almost overcome in a sense, right? Like, you were a war fighter. So with the war fighter comes this certain stereotype that ignores a lot of other stereotypes that come along with this community, such as empathy. And for the most part, members of this community, you know, are certainly trained for conflict, but also trained to not be seen or heard, also trained to be in and out without conflict. So it's certainly not a conflict averse community, right? But at the same time, there is a gentleness to their sophistication when it comes to avoiding conflict as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to switch gears to Broom Ventures, venture capital. You've made a very cool transition over the course of your career from military, right? And having that that injury be the best thing that ever happened to you, right? And now you're doing very cool stuff in technology. So, I mean, maybe we could start with a question I've always wondered, and I wasn't able to stalk you and find the answer anywhere. Maybe I just didn't look hard enough on the Broom Ventures website. Why the name? Why Broom Ventures?
Oh, sure. This is a great question. And we certainly, I need to publish something on this actually about why it was Broom Ventures. But it's very simple. So Broom is the universal sign for hard work anywhere in the world. So if you were to show up in India, if you were to show up in different parts of Asia, if you were to show up in Europe, if you were to show up in parts of Africa, it doesn't matter what country. If you go into someone's home, up against the wall or in the corner or over in a small closet, you'll find a broom. And for me, I wanted something that wasn't, I wanted something that truly represented my leadership style and my co-founders, their leadership style, which is behind the scenes, which is no job too big or small, even to the point of sweeping floors or whatever, what have you. So that's why we came up with the concept of Broom Ventures. It's the universal sign for hard work, and you go and get it when there's a very specific job to do, and that job typically entails work. And that's us. That's the way that we wanted founders and founding teams to imagine us on their cap table doing those types of things. you know, hard work, rolling up the sleeves and no job too big or small.
What is leading like as an investor? Obviously, for someone who is, let's say, a portfolio manager for a mutual fund or is designing an ETF or working in, you know, perhaps a different investment arm of finance besides venture capital or maybe private equity, right? Like, you know, they are one type of investor where leadership plays a much smaller role, right? It's more about the pure finance. I am curious how you think of leading in the construct of not only the firm of Broom Ventures, but then leading across your portfolio.
Yes, that's a great question, Andrew. That is a great question. So first, I want to talk about why did I choose entrepreneurs to be the community that I serve post-serving a veteran-oriented community. So when you think about it this way, and I want to be careful of this analogy because entrepreneurs don't say this to me, and I certainly don't think of them in the same way that I think of a special operations veteran. But in a very real sense, special operators, I did this, you did this, others did this. We had to sign our name on a dotted line to give our life, quite literally, for a cause that's much bigger than ourselves. Right? Like, took a pen, and there's something about that. Right? It is a contract. It is a covenant with our country that we are willing to give up our lives for something much bigger than ourselves. Right? So put that over here. Now, as I went through the exercise that I explained earlier, what was it about the teams that I admire? What was it about the leadership of this community that I admired? What was it about the culture that attracted me so deeply to want to serve in the SEAL community and so on? When I did that audit, there was one community that came to mind that also signs their name on a metaphorical dotted line to give their life to something much bigger than themselves. And that is an entrepreneur, right? So when I made that transition in my mind, I am not very good at advocating on behalf of me. I'm very good at advocating on behalf of a community that I believe in. So that's why when people say, like, how did you build the Honor Foundation? It's like, I believe so deeply in the people that I was out there raising dollars for and information and time, talent, treasure from thousands of people around the country. It was so easy for me because I was representing a community that I believed in, right? It's the same thing with entrepreneurs. So instead of 40 fellows in a classroom, I now have 40 founders in a portfolio where all my effort, energy, enthusiasm, excitement, network, it's all dedicated to them and their interests, which was why when people think about the nonprofit transition to being called an actual capitalist, a venture capitalist, like when you think of it that way, it doesn't make sense, but that's thinking about it incorrectly. It's a set of skills that I was doing over here that also applied over here. And it's all about the community that you serve, right? So I wanted to serve a community of entrepreneurs that I believe in. And the good thing about VC is that our interests are all aligned. I invested capital in you. So now giving all of that I am, all my effort, energy, enthusiasms, you know, network, everything, pushing it in your direction, it's now aligned with my incentives, right? And you will take those, everything I push in your direction because you want to succeed as a business, right? An individual fellow that comes through our program is no different than an individual founder building a business. That fellow is also a business all into him or herself. And I'm trying to get them to organize themselves like a business, but as an individual. Now I'm working on companies as kind of a owner, coach, and sometimes player. So that when you ask like how I organized myself, it was very difficult to move from operator, like sole operator as CEO of this foundation, serving operators, right? So the whole community, I mean that in the kind of they were operators in a warfighting sense, but they were also operators in the way they thought about doing work, right? And then you switch into venture where I am I am as hands-on with my companies as they will allow me to be. It's like I offer up a menu of options and they choose what they would like me to do on their behalf, whether it's a biweekly leadership call, facilitating conversations amongst the leadership team, or if it's in network introductions, it doesn't matter. They tell me how they want me to play. But no matter what, I'm still an owner because I invested in their company. So I literally own some of the company, right? It's an equity investment. So there's times you're always an owner in venture, right? By nature of the business and the model. But the biggest differences in venture capital you will see are the people that are switching between the roles of coach and player, right? It's not often. I'm a 90s kid. I grew up in Chicago, right? It wasn't often that I saw Phil Jackson jump on the court to help out Michael on a big play, right? So there are the VCs that are strictly coaches. And then, you know, there are VCs that are, you know, let's use a Mark Cuban. He's not actually on the court, right? Yeah. Physically playing, but man, he has a court presence, okay? And he's not up in the owner's box very often. All right, so that's the more hands-on type VC. And some funds have built entire models around this. Our fund, we are hands-on in the sense of we like to be engaged. We like to punch above our weight. Every fund that I create will always have this attitude of put us to work and we will get work done on your behalf. So that's the reason why, that's how I would probably describe how I got into venture is finding I didn't think of it in regards to dollars or money or returns or even the model. I said, who do I want to serve with my time? All right. I wish more people thought of their professional career this way. Right? Who do I want to serve with my time? If you're going into a company, it would be the customers. You're not going into the company. You're going in the company to serve a certain category of customer. So you have to believe in those customers. That's what will get you in and out of bed every day to serve the mission alongside people who care about a certain group of customers.
Yeah. I don't want people to miss that because I think it might be so obvious to some people, but not that obvious to other people. The point you made there about being passionate about customers, because I think a lot of people go to work or choose a career perhaps for the wrong reasons, right? It's just based purely off of the compensation maybe and the financial upside, or it's based upon, you know, what kind of peer group they'll have or interesting domain knowledge, right? Especially in technology, there's no dearth of interesting things to do from an academic standpoint. But I tell you, the most rewarding experiences that I've had in the private sector, you know, and seen other people have, and the cultures that I've been involved with are the ones where the customers are, first of all, worth serving. And then, you know, secondly, where everyone else is really passionate about serving those customers. And if either one of those things is off, it's really hard to be motivated. It's really hard to be successful, yes, obviously, when you're not motivated. So, I think, you know, it might sound simple, but people, you know, if you look at your own lives, you may not be actually, you know, kind of living according to that principle.
Well, think of the way people describe the work in the military. They literally call it military service, right? Because everyone knows that the military is in service to who? They are in service to the American people. All right. So you're called to serve. Okay. When you say the military, I felt a call to serve. Well, serve what? Well, the American people. And what you're really saying is this set of documents that came out several hundreds of years ago, and our Declaration and our Constitution, you are willing to fight and die to protect those documents and what they stand for, and therefore protect the American people. You're in service to that, right? So I don't think enough folks sit back and think who they're going to be in service to. And here's why I say, you know, I think that this is kind of a widespread pandemic amongst kind of the American worker. Is I've seen so many people call themselves a recovering fill in the blank, right? I'm a recovering attorney, or I'm a recovering investment banker. I'm a recovering and they joke when they say it, of course, but the one thing that they didn't think of is who they were going to serve while they were working at said institution. And so if I can create an institution by design, which is, you know, why I'm narrowing my focus in venture now to focus much more on defense and defense teams, is because I'm noticing that the in the dual use and defense sector, those folks are, they are so passionate about who they are serving, right? They're serving not only customers, but they're serving customers, or as founders, I should say. I talk about the mission of this kind of next fund is, you know, I imagine a world, one, where all democracies feel safe. The mission of this fund is to find fund and follow on with mission first founders who aim to win. And mission first founders are defined very clearly in this set of bylaws that talks about founders that are building things in the direction and in support of the national security and economic security of the United States and her allies. There's something about businesses that are building in the direction of service to that, to mission first. Right. And so I want to support those founders. I want to raise money on behalf of those founders. I want to deploy capital to those founders. I want to continue to invest in, I want to find them, I want to fund them, and I want to follow on with those founders as long as they'll have me on the cap table. So I want to serve those who are, who have those they are serving at the forefront of their mission. And the way they talk about that is crystal clear.
I love it. I love it. That's super exciting. So I just want to make sure that we got the details straight here. So it's BVVC is the new entity, right? That, and you're raising a whole bunch of money, I think, this summer for this new fund. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So you think of Broom as a generalist strategy. We were a generalist fund. We were sector agnostic, but very stage specific. Any and all technology. We just wanted to find the most extraordinary teams, leaders, and cultures to invest in. Well, as it turns out, a third of that portfolio ended up being defense-oriented. And the majority of those opportunities that I had the chance to work with on bi-weekly calls, tri-weekly calls, monthly calls, you know, as an informal advisor, it was all in the dual-use strategy. And I, again, it's like you use opportunities to sharpen your focus, right? This is something I tell veterans all the time in transition. Just because you came into the military, served 20 years, doesn't mean you're going to go into your next opportunity and that's it for the next 20 years, right? So, but they're so dedicated, and of course they're so passionate, and they're so committed, and they're loyal. So they come out and they think, okay, this next step, this is it. Like, this is going to be my next step. No, it's a forcing function. It's a funnel. You're getting out. You're jumping out. You're jumping in. You're going to figure out whether you need to narrow the aperture a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more. And now you've got your opportunity that you end up keeping for several years. It's the same thing here. Where I jumped into VC because I knew who I wanted to serve. I wanted to serve entrepreneurs, right? Then once I jumped in, I realized that a third of this portfolio truly, 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 truly lights me on fire in the way that they talk about their customer and who they're serving. So now I want to do that, and I narrowed the aperture, and now I'm going to go into to focus on the dual use space, the defense innovation. I want to be clear that the dual use space is everything from, you know, biotech companies into quantum computing into big software, computer software projects, and into even computer hardware. So it's such a broad description inside of that kind of narrow aperture of dual use. And all in the national security and economic security interests of our country. And I want to support in that direction.
Yeah, the dual use is interesting because it's not a vertical in and of itself. It's like an attribute of a business that then you can filter by. It's interesting.
That's right. It's like a genre of music, right?
right. I'm curious about this. So how do you think about two questions come from that. One is kind of how you're able to actually stay focused then, right? Because the temptation of, you know, smart, energetic people, I think, is to then just, you know, see all the bright lights and all the, you know, as the dog and like want to chase them all. And, oh, like, you know, I'm going to read a ton about biotechnology. Oh, like the next day, like, oh, I'm going to, you know, what about space and rockets? And like, oh, now, like, what about undersea stuff? You know, all sorts of crazy stuff, right? So, yeah. So how do you kind of stop yourself from doing that? Obviously, you have a team there. It's not just you're not just an army of one, so to speak. But yes. but how do you stay focused? And then I'm also thinking about what the implications of focus are, specifically in venture, around how you operate, how you filter investments, you know, what the risks are to the firm, you know, that sort of stuff. Kind of a grab bag of questions. Sorry.
No. So like, how do you narrow the focus? So how do you narrow the focus into dual use technology? And so look, there's every fund has a thesis, every fund has a strategy. And for me, the way I, you know, kind of narrow it down is obvious. There are, number one, when I think of frontier technology in the dual use and defense space, there are certain technologies that we have a head start with, but our adversaries are quickly catching up. So I want to be clear. When we talk about, I want everyone in the audience to think of kind of the top three technology giants in the world. All right, just think of the top three that come to mind that are adversarial to the United States. All right. Or just the top three in general, because it just happens to be adversarial, the runners up, let's say. But I can tell you this, if the United States loses ground or falls behind, I want you to replace us as the technology giant in the world with one or two of those folks that are before us. And you have to ask yourself, do you want those people to be the technology leaders on the planet? And the answer is universally no. All right, the answer is universally no, we do not. So, when I think about that, it becomes very clear, and it actually is the forcing function for you to focus, that if we do not focus on artificial intelligence as a nation, and if we do take this strategic pause, you have to ask yourself, if we take a strategic pause, will our enemies also take that pause? And the answer is no. No, they will not. All right, we already took a pause for 20 years from focusing on these things because we were fighting a war against an ancient enemy where we were wrapping a bunch of hardware around a little bit of software when our enemies were learning how to wrap a bunch of software around a little bit of hardware. And that gave them some runway to catch up to us. And to put things in perspective, from 1999 to 2020, that 20-year period or so, the Chinese were inside of 50% of every deal done in Silicon Valley where AI was concerned. All right, so that's 50% of all Silicon Valley deals for 20 years. The Chinese were on the cap table, so that's a problem. They're catching up. All right, they haven't beat us, but they're catching up. So now is the time for us to push on the pedal. And to answer your question, we have to focus, hyper focus on artificial intelligence, big data analysis. We have to focus on quantum computing. We have to focus on hypersonics, as if our lives depend on it, because they do. So it might be easy for some other folks to kind of lose sight of a goal, or, you know, take their time and build a strategy and roam on their thesis. Not me. Like, not now. Like, we cannot afford to do this in a manner without great urgency. So again, who you serve determines how focused you are. And right now, we are serving the American people, and they don't feel safe. We're serving the defense industry, who are trying to, again, have a massive head start above our competition. And I hope to produce technology where our warfighters never face a fair fight. That's the point. We don't want fair fights, all right? So I hope to contribute in a small way in that direction. Of never having a fair fight, and we will be hyper focused on the special operations community.
Amazing. Last few questions here, kind of bringing it full circle to leadership. So we talked about your leadership style and philosophy when it comes to venture, and I think you said something along the lines of, "I'll play as much as people want me to play," or something like that. You know, your founders want you to play in your portfolio. When do you let people fail?
That's a great question. Yeah. So, you know, we serve entrepreneurs, but at the end of the day, we are really serving our limited partners, our investors. right? We want to see our investors become wildly successful. We want to make them tremendous amounts of money. We want them to look at our fund as a vehicle that provided them that opportunity. So I want to say that, because that's a big part of leadership and venture, is the types of respect that you have for your investors and the types of investors you've recruited into the mission of your fund, right? So everyone has to be aligned. And the reason why I bring that up and when do you let people fail is it's a very gentle dance that you have to play. And I had a friend and a mentor, tell me something one time that I'll never forget about when do you let founders fail. And you have to very quickly, in the moment, you have to make a decision that if I say anything right now in this moment, will it actually have the adverse effect that I hope it has if this person were to learn this lesson on their own? Now, you don't have time to think about this, because in some cases you do, but most cases you don't. And if I think it's going to negatively impact a founder trajectory, I will talk about it. It's the way you talk about things. So the way that I talk about opinions is just that. It's my opinion. My opinion here is fill in the blank, but I need you to make the decision for yourself, right? So it's no different than if you were leading a team of men and women on the battlefield, or whether you are leading this. It's like there are certain lessons. The bottom lines are different here. That's the point that I'm trying to make. The bottom line in the military is loss of life, right? The bottom line in business is loss of dollars. And those two bottom lines are very different. And so while we think of outcomes in terms of what is the best outcome for the company and the founder, we want them to make the right decisions. And then obviously we want those decisions to impact the portfolio. Therefore, the best decision we possibly could make is the one that benefits our investor. But there are times where allowing founders to learn lessons on their own, I am not a subject matter expert in any one of our companies. I have a given level of a certain level of expertise, in some cases more so in industries than others. But who am I to tell, you know, our founder in the shipping and supply and logistics supply chain space, who am I to tell him how to do his business? What I can give him is an opinion on how to lead in the moment and how to properly and objectively think through a situation. And that's what he leans on me for, right? I'm very clear on my founders on what to lean on me for. There's advisors for our founders that you lean on them for this information. And the best founders are the ones that come to me with hyper-focused questions, laser-focused questions, where you can tell that the question that they have arrived at is so precise that it comes from this whole journey to get to this one question. And that's also how I determine who to invest in at times, are the questions that they ask throughout our conversations. Questions reveal a certain depth of knowledge and also a certain intuition that's very important when making an investment decision. So hopefully that touched on your question.
Yeah. An example from a different domain that I think lends some support for your point about questions is a buddy of mine after business school. When I was on Wall Street for a 4A trading commodities derivatives, getting an internship alone on Wall Street is pretty hard, right? And then getting a full-time offer is also very hard. And we used to joke that we'd start a consulting agency for basically undergrads primarily, but MBAs also. And the only service we would provide them is you tell me, okay, you're going to whatever, the structured debt desks. Here's some questions to ask. And literally that's all we would give them is questions, because you could always tell how smart someone was by the questions they asked, not the answers they had already.
That's right.
Super interesting.
And just being cognizant of time, I do have to jump in 2 minutes, but, I want to let you know that there's so many lessons that I've learned and failures that I've learned over the last couple of years, even, you know, failures on friendships. Like, I divide my whole life back to the structure that we talked about according to the fund, the firm, the foundation, family, and friends. Those five things. And those five things are constantly under audit, right? The fund, the firm, the foundation, family, friends. And my those five things are reflected in my calendar, and they're all color coded, and I can see how much percentage of time is spent on these five things every single week. And then I have my, you know, journal that I keep of everything that goes on into a quarter, and I spend too much time here and I spend too much time there. And, you know, my chief of staff argues with me, or I should say encourages me. I do devote a lot of time to foundation work, right? Because it's also fuel. It's fuel for me. You know, you and I, we get compensated in many different ways. And pay is one of them. But these conversations are another. And you know, a leadership conversation with a friend, that's another. And, you know, helping a little cousin apply to Intel school, that's another. So there's all these different things that compensate us in life. And she's just trying to keep me in balance with my priorities. But, I would say those five things are pretty important to anybody, the work that they do in the family and the friends component, but keeping a stronger audit of all those things are pretty important.
Well, that is a wonderful place to end, Joe. You said it yourself.
Thank you, sir.
We are the average of the five people around us, and we got to be around you today. Right. And so we leveled up.
Thank you.
So much appreciated. Thanks so much.
All right, my man. And we'll talk soon.
Brainiac Productions. If you like The Warrior Poet, there's more great content on Instagram. Follow Sri, The Warrior Poet, on Instagram. That's S-R-I, The Warrior Poet. You can also get to know me on a personal level by following Sri, actually, on Instagram as well. The Warrior Poet is produced by Laddie, with special contributions by Spoonman and me, Sri.
No, 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 no. Kevin, me na duwa. Spita.